Hi, I'm Femi Oke. Welcome to the bonus edition of The Stream, where I bring you some of the great conversations from our archives. Today, guests who've turned their extraordinary personal stories into life lessons for us all. Coming up, the foster kid who became an award-winning poet, the mum who walked away from her PhD to become a publisher of South Asian children's literature, and the writer whose encounters with mediocre white men inspired her latest book. Let's start with disability rights attorney Harbin Girma, the first deafblind graduate of Harvard Law School. Harbin brought along her hearing translator to the stream. The translator typed what was happening in the studio into a keyboard. That information was sent wirelessly to Harbin's Braille computer so she could read it and respond. The interview about her memoir was seamless.
So my parents love and adore me. They also are a little protective, like many parents. And growing up, we struggled with the challenge of my parents wanting to keep me safe and protected, and me wanting to experience as much of the world as possible. I'm deafblind, I have limited vision and hearing. And there are a lot of negative stereotypes about what people with disabilities can and can't do. And that's the heart of the arguments I've had with my parents growing up. There was a situation where I wanted to help build a school in Mali, West Africa. And my parents said, no, it's not safe. And I told them, you are from Africa. My dad grew up in Ethiopia. My mom grew up in Eritrea. How could they tell me it's not safe? It was because they were feeling protective as parents. It had nothing to do with Africa. Even if I was building a school in, say, Montana, I'm sure they would have told me, no, it's not safe. So I tried, and this is a story of advocacy. So I advocated and I told them, I know my abilities. I know what I can and can't do, and I can build a school. And they still said no. I was really frustrated. I'm sure lots of kids can relate to this, of wanting to do something and your parents saying no. So I asked myself, how can I convince them? They're not believing me, even though I feel like an expert when it comes to my abilities. So I asked myself, who else can help convince them that I can do this? So we brought in the program manager who take students to developing countries to help build schools. And she sat down at lunch with me and my parents, and they asked her, how can Harbin build a school? She can't see. How would that work? And the manager told them, I don't know, but we'll try. We'll find a way. It's okay if you don't know how to do something, as long as you try to seek solutions. As long as you try to figure it out and make it work. And we did. I went to Mali. I helped build a school. And I literally mean building a school. We were shoveling, making bricks, digging the latrine so that kids in this village in Mali could get an education. The heart of the program, though, was about teaching high school students that we can have an impact in the world. Even if you have a disability, you still can have an impact in the world. When I came back home, my parents were more convinced, but only slightly. Even now, even after graduating from law school, they're still nervous and still protective.
You tell a story, you use it as an illustration, you give some stats, and then you say, do better. This is how we can do better. I am sharing a picture with our audience of you in Juneau in Alaska at a glacier. And that was a time when you were hoping to get a summer job. You were super qualified, really smart student, and you couldn't get a job. And you share the statistic of about 70% of blind people never work. So this idea of being a person with disabilities and not being able to work, how are you working to change that?
That's a good question. So when I was in college, I really wanted a summer job, just like lots of other college students. And one of my friends told me, I know a place where there are lots of summer jobs, Alaska. And he was right. There's a large tourism industry in Juneau, Alaska, and lots of summer jobs because of the tourism industry. Employers would see my resume and get excited and invite me to interviews. I was valedictorian in high school, really good grades in college, lots of volunteer experiences, and still employers didn't want to hire me. Ableism. Assumptions that I was incompetent, I would not be able to do the job. I applied to all kinds of jobs, dishwashing, shelving gift shops, folding laundry in hotel. These are tactile activities. They don't require sight, but they still assumed I couldn't do it and they wouldn't hire me. That introduced me to employment discrimination, and it made me realize working hard is not enough. We also need employers to get rid of ableism. Stop assuming that people with disabilities are incompetent. Eventually that summer, I found one employer who was inclusive. She hired me to be a front desk clerk at a small gym in Juneau, Alaska. So my responsibilities included managing the cash register, the machines in the gym, cleaning the changing rooms. She didn't care whether I used sight or non-visual technique, as long as I got the job done. Lots of people with disabilities have alternative techniques, and alternative techniques are equal in value to mainstream techniques. Employers need to know that. One day, a woman came to the front desk of the gym and she said, a treadmill isn't working. I followed her to the treadmills and I pressed the on button. Nothing happened. I tried the other buttons on the machine. Nothing happened. So I felt the machine from top to bottom. And on the bottom, I felt a switch. I flicked the switch and the machine went to life. The lady says, oh my goodness, I didn't see that switch. I told her I didn't see it either.
The very funny and determined disability rights advocate, Harwin Gerber. There are some stream guests who are simply unforgettable, like the poet and playwright Lem Cissé. Lem grew up in the north of England in foster care and institutions. His story is traumatic, and Lem doesn't hold back. He unleashed the rawness in his memoir, My Name Is Why, and right here on the stream.
For the first 16 years of my life, I thought my name was Norman. I left the care system at 18 years of age with no family and no witnesses. I was living and had been forced to live as a lie. I had my mother and family stolen from me. I was imprisoned as a child. I was institutionalised. I was dragged through a foster home of people who hated me as a baby and learned to hate me. And then I was left alone at 18 years to survive the rest of my life with no family. So I spent 30 years trying to get the documents which were witness to the things that had happened to me, because otherwise I would sound like some crazy guy banging on about some strange thing that happened in his childhood. No, I was imprisoned, I had my mother stolen from me and my family and even my name. I didn't even know my name till I was 16 and a half. So getting these files and seeing what they did to me over 18 years showed me the evidence that I needed to take the entire government in England to court so that they could pay for what they had done to me. And I also spent my adult life searching for the family that had been stolen from me. That's one story. But this book, firstly, I took the government to court when I got all of the files in 2015, I had the evidence of what they'd done to me. And then I could write the book. And remember, my life has been public record. Hundreds of people writing comments about me, making decisions about me, imprisoning me even as a child. So to me, the memoir is not an expose of myself. It is showing you what is already public record. I have a right to my past. I have a right to my childhood. And I have a right to my future and my present as well. And that's really what my book is about.
I realised, I am a black man, I said to myself. I am a black man. I am not colourblind. I am a black man. I am not chalky white. I am not a nigger, a coon, a wog. I am a black man. I changed seemingly overnight from the cheeky chappy, the happy-go-lucky joker into a threat. And it hurt me. How could identifying who I am be a threat to people? I couldn't unsee the shopkeeper flush red from the neck upwards at the sight of me, or the store detectives following me in the shops, at the bus stops. I couldn't unsee the woman clutching her handbag as I stood waiting for the bus. I couldn't unsee that no one would sit next to me on the bus. I couldn't unsee men glaring at me. I couldn't unsee people in cars craning their necks to stare at me. I couldn't unsee the people from the tops of the buses pointing at me and laughing at me. I couldn't unsee them hacking up phlegm and spitting at me from the bus. I couldn't unsee the police watching me or the police cars slowing down deliberately as they passed. I couldn't unsee the cars accelerating as I crossed the road.
Lam, thank you for that.
I found myself.
Powerful moment, powerful reading. Your work is poetic and beautiful, even as you're telling harrowing tales and stories about what happened to you. I want to share what your work means to some people. This is Tony Mason on Twitter, who says, just finished My Name Is Why. It is superbly written, harrowing, thought-provoking, and shocking read. How wonderful to see the kid that went through all of this as he is today. But put that to one side for a moment, because earlier you mentioned that you're not alone in this, in a way. You mentioned some documentaries that talk about the system of adoption, and one of them was featured on Al Jazeera's Witness. It's called A Girl in Return. We have a
Girl
video comment.
Return.
We have a video
yes.
comment from the director, who's a friend of yours, Catherine Pierre, and here's what she told the stream.
I think the biggest surprise to me during my work with these two films I've done about adoption is with the first one, Mercy Mercy, was definitely when I found out that 90%, approximately 90% of all the orphans in the world, they are not really orphans. They do have a living mother and father, but they are not able to take care of them. And with my work on Girl in Return, I was very, very shocked to see how much your culture and your mother tongue, how important that is for you when you are formed as a person. That, I mean, one could say that it kind of runs in your blood, and you need, if you exclude that from a person, you create a big trauma from this person. And I would like to hear Lem talk about how he experienced that whole cultural thing, or the lack of it in his upbringing.
So, Lem, I want your thoughts on that, but keep in mind, as we're doing the show, we're going out live on YouTube, and there are so many people in the comments saying, he's Ethiopian, he is Habesha, I know him. So talk to us about that cultural identity, because people recognize you whether you knew as a young child or not.
No, I am now known to my people, okay? Like, I am known to my people in Ethiopia, and I'm blessed by being part of a community of Ethiopians in Ethiopia and throughout the world. You know, my father was a pilot for Ethiopian Airlines. My mum works for the UN in New York. I have sisters and brothers all over the world. But the true family is of people who stop me in the street in Addis Ababa, in New York, in Washington, D.C., especially Washington, D.C., but in Nairobi, all over the world, who are Ethiopians, who can look at me and say, it's you, Lemon, they say. Lemon. My name in Amharic, Lemon. It means the question why. And it reminds me most of all this, that, and this is the most important thing that about my entire life and finding my family and of Ethiopia in general, but of me. It's that I am not defined by my scars, but by the incredible ability to heal. So when I meet Ethiopians, I, 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 I am healing. And so it's a joyous occasion. My story may seem sad to you, but I always followed the light. I always followed what I believed to be the truth, even when isolated and having nobody to support me.
A great son of Ethiopia, Lemon Sisse. Ijoma Oluo never planned on becoming a writer until she says she was forced into it. Some issues were just too important for her to ignore, like racism and misogyny. Last January, we spoke about her latest work, Mediocre, The Dangerous Legacy of White Male America.
The inspiration for this was born out of, you know, a lifetime of frustration, but a particular moment. And the moment was, you know, trying to be in a writer's retreat with other women. And this was a time to relax, to focus on our craft. It was a retreat, you know, that was really developed because women so rarely get a chance to focus on their work. And all we could really talk about and what we needed to talk about were these men, these white men that were impacting our lives and our careers so heavily. And in it, as people kept saying, why does this, you know, why is this happening? What is behind this? You know, I kept seeing the story unfold in front of me, the path that led to where we were in that particular time and where we are today. And I wanted other people to see it, so that we could start looking at the patterns and looking at society as a whole, instead of treating each individual bad actor like an individual instead of part of a systemic problem. And so I wanted to really show that story to people so they could see it too.
On YouTube again, you're really inspiring a lot of conversations, Joe. I know you're used to this. This is Fly with Derek. How long is it going to take before things ever change, since it seems America has always had this issue? What are the main things that will lead to change? You are asked this question all of the time.
I really am. And I think it's really important to recognize that part of why we haven't been able to make progress online. So there's a couple of things that happen. One is that we have, you know, almost exclusively framed discussions on racism around personal feelings and personal animus. You are a racist if you walk around actively hating people of color, right? You are sexist if you walk around actively hating women. And then if not, you are a good person, part of the solution. But what we're actually talking about are systems. We're talking about systems built to advantage some populations over others, systems built to exploit the labor of members of our population and to give people a sense of comfort with that exploitation and oppression. And we are told to look at interpersonal relationships only because people make money off of these systems and gain power from these systems and don't want us looking at it. So when we do engage systems, right, when we start to make political change, systemic change, what we see is an immediate violent backlash like we saw this past week. Right? Because people are so afraid of systemic change. And so we have to recognize it's by design that we haven't been addressing and making the sort of change in our systems, because we've been told time and time again it's not possible, or that's not where the problem lies, or we have been punished so viciously for any progress we make in that area. And so it is vital that we look at that and recognize that this is where our work lies and we have to push through. We have never-ending opportunities. These systems were built by people. They are not immovable. But we are told that they are, and we are led to believe that they are, so that we won't do the work. But we are powerful. If we come together and actually start engaging in our systems to really push for change, we can create it. And that, and if we couldn't create it, there wouldn't be such a violent backlash towards our attempts. It's because people see that change coming and they are afraid of it.
When you work on a book like this, there is a toll when you talk about racism and white supremacy and hate. And people who don't like you talking about that make it very, very clear. Can you share that part of your work? Do you mind?
Yeah, you know, I think that anyone who, especially if you are a person of color, especially if you are a black woman, when you threaten the system comes back for you, and people who are invested in the system come for you. And absolutely, my experience, while it might seem extreme if you're not doing this work, is not unfamiliar to many black people who have been fighting for liberation and for change in this country. And so, you know, we have been threatened. We have had, you know, officers brought to our home when we were swatted. We have had to move from our home due to regular harassment and threats in our home. This is a regular occurrence, and I am not alone. And if you look at history, and even if you look at the book, you'll see time and time again, generation after generation, the way in which people are made to pay for speaking up around these systems. But I think it's also important to note that this comes for people, everyday people who aren't writing about white supremacy, everyday people of color who do something, anything, that inconveniences the power structure, that inconveniences whiteness in this country. You're often met with a violent backlash. And we see this in plenty of our news stories where, you know, black people can't have a barbecue or, you know, sell lemonade without someone calling the police on them, right? These violent repercussions are waiting for all of us, no matter what we do, if we ever challenge the system or even inconvenience it.
Best-selling New York Times author Ijoma Oluo. Finally, the importance of representation in books. When Stream guest Salja Joshi was starting her family, she couldn't find stories that she liked that also represented her culture to read to her little girl. So, what did she do about it? Salja set up a publishing house.
So the journey to creating Bharat Babies really started my own journey to motherhood. I was pregnant with my daughter and I was having this library-themed baby shower, as you do in the age of Pinterest. And I really wanted to put books on our bookshelf that reflected my own culture, my history, my heritage. And what I found out there was really problematic. You know, there were books out there, but some of them were developmentally inappropriate. Some of them were culturally inaccurate, or worse, culturally insensitive. And I couldn't believe that in this day and age, my daughter wasn't going to see herself on the cover of the book. So it took leaving my PhD program and $1,000 of startup capital, but that's how Bharat Babies was launched.
We have a tweet here that is perfect for you, because this is Ivan Ash, who says, there aren't enough platforms that allow people of color to write stories in their own way. Publishing houses expect writers to write in a manner that they want, not that the writers want. He who has the money has the power to dictate what he wants, and I'll add in she as well. But talk to us about what this tweet makes you feel, and if this was some of the thinking behind why you started it.
Yeah, I think I truly wanted to create a platform where the South Asian experience could be seen and heard and created. And that's why it ended up being a publishing house. You know, I tried writing a book and, you know, maybe one day there will be a book that I write. But for some reason, it wasn't what was going to happen. And so instead, I decided to launch this publishing house because I realized just how important it was to give a platform to others and to give a platform to this entire community.
Salja, you were saying that you couldn't find the right books for the family that you were starting. I'm just scooting through some of the books in your publishing house. We have Finding Om coming out next May. Padmini is Powerful, Always Anjali, Sala in the Sky. We have an art series as well. Can you tell us one story that shows what to be culturally sensitive, to be culturally aware, actually means?
Oh, it's a really, really great question. And I think each one of our books does a really phenomenal job of sharing that South Asian experience, because we recognize that the South Asian experience isn't unified. It's multidimensional. You know, you have South Asians who are Muslim, who are Hindu, who are Christian, who are Sikh. And we want to share all of that. I think there are a lot of books in our platform that do that really, really well. Mm-hmm. Let's Celebrate Diwali is one of our sort of perennial favorites that really shares how Diwali is a multi-faith holiday. And that's a story that's not often told in mainstream media. Also, I think Super Satya Saves the Day is a really phenomenal story because, like, right there on the cover, you have this multicultural family. You know, you have a dad wearing his turban. You have his daughter who's proudly Sikh, with her long, long hair on the cover. And it's really just an opportunity for those of us who have so many different backgrounds, who have all those different intersections, to see ourselves.
And that's our show for today. Thanks for watching.